Yeah, because we're getting into the meat of things right here. This is how it works. This is all the nuts and bolts right here. And if you thought we were fired up before, wait till you. This is. I love this stuff.
I think that's what a lot of them thought of. That's why they all disappeared.
They left. Well, shame on them. You have my permission to call in the middle of the rotor when they show up tomorrow, okay? All right, here we go. Chapter 5, how it works. And if you think about this, I mean, how many groups, it's got to be at least in the high 90% of all the groups everywhere read this at every meeting, right? You could probably, I mean, lots of, or at least in Texas, everywhere you go, they open with their meeting like this, right? And we could quote this. But it was until I got sober and my sponsor, we went through and we broke it down. And I was like, wow, I didn't know there was so much information in this stuff right here, what we always read. So check this out. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Well, you go back to the statistics they had, the old-timey groups that they had where they were doing anywhere from 50 to 75% to 90%. That's a true statement. Rarely did they see anyone fail who thoroughly followed this path. True statement today. Rarely have... Hey, all the guys that I sponsored that thoroughly follow this path, they are sober today. Every single one of them. The guys who didn't thoroughly follow the path, all bets are off. We can twist that sentence around and say, rarely have I seen anyone thoroughly follow this path. Because they got their own ideas, they got their own way of doing things. Well, I'm going to do this. They don't want to be held accountable. They don't want to get into the steps, whatever. But it's a true statement. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. All right? Whole lot of information there. They describe these people who don't recover. Cannots and will nots. Right? I don't know many cannots. Like I told you before, I've never met anybody, I haven't sponsored anybody that was too dumb to get sober. I've sponsored a whole lot of people or tried to that were too damn smart. You know? But there is that class of people that cannot get sober. They've developed wet brain or whatnot, you know, and they can't get it. Constitutionally incapable. Right? And look what it says of being honest with themselves. And there's a couple ways to look at it, but the way I look at it is this. Here is a prescription for a miracle, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to get me from a hopeless state of mind and body to the power. Today, just like it was way back when I got sober, if I am being honest with myself, I will do whatever it takes today to follow these principles. That is being honest with myself. I wake up tomorrow and I choose not to call my sponsor. I choose not to make an amends. I choose not to do a 10 step. I choose not to pray and meditate. I choose not to practice these principles. I'm basically looking up at the big guy saying, thank you, I got it from here. I'm not being honest with myself. Because here is the prescription right here. If I'm being honest, I will follow these directions. If I choose not to follow these directions, I'm not being honest with myself because I'm telling myself, self, I got this thing whooped. It says, there are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. If you follow these principles to the best of your ability, it will demand rigorous honesty. You know, and we'll get into that as we get into the steps, but there's lots of things. You know, it tells us that we let God discipline us in the way that we have just outlined. How did they just outline? They just outlined the steps, right? It says their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Thank God for that statement, right? It says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. You get asked to speak before a group, that's how you do your story. What am I supposed to tell them? What I used to be like, what happened to me, what I'm like now. Bill did a masterful job in doing his story. He did it just like that, right? And that's what our stories disclose. Why? For the identification. So A, the alcoholic can identify with us, say, hey, I'm one of those two, and get some hope. Right? You can underline this, Larry. Because here's a qualification. I'm not picking on Larry. He asked me to point some things out, so I'm following orders, okay? But here's a qualification right here. It says, if you have decided you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take the steps. Oh, I wanted what you had in 1998 or 97 or 96, but I wasn't willing to do a damn thing about it. I wanted to slide into AA because I earned my seat and I guess get sober by osmosis. I wasn't willing to do anything about it. I wasn't willing to crack open this book. I wasn't willing to get a sponsor. I wasn't willing to do anything. This says, if you want what I got and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take the steps. At some of these we balked. You betcha. I got to do what? An inventory? I got to make amends to who? At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. What are some of those easier, softer ways? How about that little trend in AA today? How about just auditing meetings? Going from meeting to meeting to meeting. There's a whole host of people in AA today that don't even have a home group. They go to this group for a while, and they go over here for a while. They do this over here for a while, right? They don't got a sponsor. They're not accountable to anyone. No one gets to know them. That's an easier, softer way. How about just not working the steps? How about lying your way through the steps? How about keeping some stuff back in the steps, right? It says, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. I got to let go. Got to let go of what I think is right, what I think should happen, the writing was on the wall. Me running the show was going to kill me. I had to let go. There was nothing else, right? Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Cunning. Lying in wait to ensnare. Alcohol just hanging. Just waiting just lurking in the bushes. Just waiting, patiently. Waiting for me to slip up. Alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God, and may you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. Half don't get you half in AA. That's been my experience. I know some of you may have skated through your schooling, gotten C's and stuff. Can't get a C in AA. I got to go for broke. Half doesn't get me half in AA. Half gets me drunk. We stood at the turning point. What is the turning point? Well, up until this point of the book, what have I come to? I've come to two conclusions so far in this book. I am screwed in step one. I'm a hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I hope what worked for you will work for me. Two conclusions, right? That's all I've done to this point. I'm screwed and I hope. Now I'm at the fork in the road. I'm at the turning point. I'm either A, going to take this road and do what I always do, drink to the bitter end, or B, I'm going to take the other fork in the road, and I'm going to make a commitment in step three to take these steps. That is the turning point. We stood at the turning point. I love this prayer. I call this the mother of all prayers right here. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. I think Earl Hightower calls it, it's like, you know, that little AA is on the cliff and he sees all the sober AAs at the bottom of the cliff and wonders how they got there. They must have found a safe way down. No, no, no. They got to run and start and leap. I got to ask his protection and care with complete abandon. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I know me running the show is not going to work out. It says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. All right, and we got the 12 steps, and I'm going to flip the page. It says, many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. Right? We're not perfect. You know, we're going to make mistakes. It's guaranteed. We're humans. We're going to screw up at times, right? It says, we're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. And here we got the ABCs. A perfect recap of steps one and two. A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Check. I got that one. B, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. My mama pleading with me didn't fix it. Those girlfriends pleading with me didn't fix it. Those psychiatrists didn't fix it. That judge threatening me didn't fix it. I am beyond human aid. C, that God couldn't, would if he were sought. I didn't know much about God, but it worked for the old man, and I hope it worked for me. It's pretty simple. Too simple for us smart folks sometimes, right? It says, being convinced of that, we're now at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. If I knew how to turn my will and life over to the care of God, I would have done that a long time ago. I got no clue on how to do that. Just what do we mean by that? The next couple of pages. And just what do? The rest of the book till page 164. The steps are going to show us how to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood them. You've heard people write into me, what step are you on? Oh, I'm just turning it over today. I'm just turning it over, right? I don't know how to turn it over. I just know how to work the steps. Take the steps. If I take the steps, I'll turn it over. It says the first, now Bill's good. I love this stuff because Bill's great at using analogies, right? And this is great stuff because he's going to tell us about us. He says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Those were my sponsor's question. How well was it working for you? It would. It says on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Now here comes the analogy. He says, each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's saying that an alcoholic is like an actor who wants to direct the movie. It's like they're shooting Martin Scorsese's in Pratt, Kansas, doing a film, right? And you get a little bit part. You got two lines in the whole friggin' movie, right? And you learn, you know your lines too. You show up the first day of filming, right? And all of a sudden you go up to Scorsese. Hey, Marty, I've been thinking about my lines, and I think I need to like ad lib a little bit here. And you know what? This makeup is not really working. And maybe if you just like tone these lights down and put this, you know. I'm like an actor who wants to direct the movie. I'm trying to arrange everything in my life to suit me. It's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of his players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Now here's some arrogance coming. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. That's my illusion. I'm trying to arrange everything in my life. If she would just get off my back. If I could just get that promotion, if I could just get the law off my back, if I could just finish my college, if I could just do all these things and you guys would get on board and do it my way, not only will I be very, very happy, so will you too. Well, that's kind of arrogant, don't you think? You don't need me bossing you around. We're going to find out what happens when we do that. But it says, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. Hey, I'm going to try what works. You know, if I need to get my way and I need you to come along with my way, I can do a lot of things, man. I can pay you some compliments, you know, wink at you, do whatever I need to do to get my way, right? And if that don't work, screw you. Because I'm going to get what I need to get. So whatever works. If the nice don't work, then I can be a jerk. You know? So what happens? The show doesn't go off very well. No, it doesn't. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Poor me. He decides to exert himself even more. So it's not going my way. So what am I doing? I throw more me at the problem. I'm running the show. It ain't going my way. And I throw more me at the problem. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit him. It ain't ever enough. It's never enough. Have you ever been in a position where you had the job, you had the relationship, you had the car, you had everything in a row, and you know what? When I got all those things, it still wasn't enough. I had to have more. I was never, ever satisfied. Maladjusted to life, I think, was what they call that. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. Sometimes I'll take the blame. I can assure you, when I take the blame, when I walk away from that situation, it's still your fault. I'm just taking the blame to get the heat off, right? He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker when even trying to be kind?
Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Right? So I'm under this illusion that I can wrest satisfaction if I manage everything well and you'll do it my way. And I eventually piss you off, you take some recriminatory action against me, and now I hate you. Does that make sense? It makes perfect sense to me. Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? We call that drama today. Drama. It's just constant drama. Oh, sorry, boss. I couldn't make it to work. I had a flat tire. This is like how many tires you got on that car? You've had 43 flat tires in a row. You know, it's just confusion rather than harmony. All the relationships are in shambles. All this is in shambles. It's crazy time. Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people call it nowadays. He's like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The retired businessman who's got everything he wants, except he's going to bitch about everything else. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who were sure that all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. Oh, yeah. And the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, our self-pity? I'm thinking about me. So that was all kind of flowery language for Bill. Now he just cuts right to the chase. He hits us right between the eyes with this. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. A book on alcoholism, and they're telling me my problem ain't alcohol, my problem is selfishness. Pretty interesting. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Fear, selfish. You ever been so locked in on fear that you can't even see straight? Everybody around you is having a good time and you're so fearful about that relationship or so fearful about that job or whatever it is that's looming large, you can't even freaking get out of it, right? Let me ask you, who were you thinking of? Self. Huh. Self-delusion. Self-seeking. That's a fun one. My sponsor loves picking out those self-seeking things, you know? I try to do something, or I think I'm doing something nice for somebody, but I really wasn't doing anything nice. I was just doing something nice so Michael would see me and think I was a good guy, you know? Self-seeking, you know? We're at this treatment center, and this guy raises his hand and goes, on my way to treatment here, the lady had a flat tire, and I helped her. That's not selfish. And my buddy Kurt goes, BS. He goes, you was totally self-seeking. Guy's like, what do you mean? He goes, dude, you didn't help her to help her. You helped her so you could get a date with her or get a $20 bill, but you weren't helping her to just be kind. You wanted something in return. Self-seeking. Tricky. And it says, we step on the toes of our fellows, they retaliate. You betcha. You don't need me bossing you around. Eventually, you're going to be at the breaking point. You're going to take some action against me. Like I said, I hate you now. I hated a lot of people back then. But here's some good stuff. It says, sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find some point in the past where we've made decisions based on self, which later places us in a position to be hurt. And that's kind of tricky. I had one of those. One that came to mind right off the bat. In the middle of the night, it was on a Sunday night, Monday morning, right? Like 3 o'clock in the morning, I had gone down to, I live in Plano, I went down to South Dallas to meet a friend.
Right? At 3 in the morning.
On the way back, I'm going through an intersection, and this lady ran the stop sign at the intersection and hit my car, totaled my car. This lady was from like Guatemala or something, illegal alien, didn't have insurance, totaled my car. I hated her because I had to put it on my insurance. It was a mess. I mean, I hate this woman. I tried to get her deported, you name it, right? And I tell my sponsor about this. And he goes, well, back up a minute. You had a job at the time, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, when did you work? I was like, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. He goes, you're out in the 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning. What were you doing down in that part of Dallas? Well, I met a friend. Well, what kind of friend was it? Well, see, I had this little pharmaceutical business I had going, right? And I was trading this guy some ecstasy for some cocaine, right? Outside issue stuff, right? He goes, huh? He goes, if I remember correctly, those things are illegal. I said, well, yeah. So you were out breaking the law. Well, yeah. Huh. So you were breaking the law, putting other people in danger so you could get other stuff. He goes, that ain't that lady's fault. Yeah, she should have insurance. We should all have insurance. But you know what? Big boy, you put yourself in that intersection. Because if you would have been home like a normal person, you wouldn't have been there. And I was like, son of a gun. I placed myself in a position to be hurt. You know? I had another girlfriend that cheated on me all the time, and I kept going back to her. I could swear it was her fault. He's like, who held the gun to your head, dude? I mean, I was like, good God. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. They all see it, I don't. Now, for all you people that sit in discussion meetings and you chant the mantra, there's no must in the big book. Here's two musts followed by a promise that'll kill you. And if you got a problem with it, contact the author. Because here's what it says. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And you can take that any way you want to take it. How is selfishness going to kill me? Selfishness, fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. Right? That stuff on page 52. Can't control my emotional natures. I'm full of fear. I'm unhappy. Can't seem to be of real help to other people. Self, 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 self. I feel that way long enough, and I'm so miserable. That hole inside of me keeps growing. I get so miserable, my mind comes up with the brilliant solution. Let's drink. Page 24 says, a week or a month after my last drink, I am unable to remember how bad it was. So if this selfishness is kicking my butt, this spiritual malady, that mental obsession is in play, I'm going to drink. And for me to drink is to die because I've lost control and drinking will kill me. That's how selfishness kills. And it says there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. I can't fix my selfishness. That's just throwing more me at the problem. I can't do it. I got to have help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, I had to quit playing God. Who was calling the shots in my life? Oh, we may believe in the power within ourselves, but who was calling the shots? I was. How did it work out for me? It wasn't. I had to quit playing God. Why? It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be the director. You need the concept for God? There you go. God's the director. You're the actor. You know, he's the principal, we are his agents. He's the father, we're his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was a keystone of a new and triumphant arch to which we pass to freedom. Look at that word, freedom. Out of all those years of me trying to get sober, out of all those desire chips and those 30-day chips and those 60-day chips, I was never, ever free. Booze owned me. Because I was going through the day thinking about not drinking. This is talking about freedom. Pretty cool stuff. Look at the middle of page 63, and there's a third step prayer. I'm going out of order, but I got a reason. Here's in the middle of the page. Here's the prayer. It says, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, right? Fear, selfishness, dishonest, and all that stuff. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness of those I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Exclamation point. Alright? That's the third set prayer. I've done it several times in AA before. So I got my last desire chip on a Tuesday, September 4th. That Saturday, I'm at my sponsor's house. I've been at my meeting, the meetings we've had during that week. I've showed up at the treatment center. I've read the stuff he's asked me to read. I show up to his house on a Saturday morning, and we go over the doctor's opinion again. We skim through we agnostics. He's asking me questions along the way, and we get right here. Big boy, are you ready to do this work? And I said, Cliff, I'll do anything. And he says, well, we'll see about that. And he said, come on. You know? And he'd given me a big book that day, and he goes, we're going to go pray. One of my prayer bench, right? So I'm following the old man through his house, and we go into the living room where nobody goes. And there's a coffee table. It wasn't a prayer bench, but I didn't pick your battles, you know? He wants to call it a prayer bench, that's fine. So we get on our knees, we open the book to this page, right? And I'm still shaking. I mean, I'm hurting alcoholically, you know? I'm still shaking and vibrating and stuff. And we put our arms around each other, and he says, before you do the prayer, he goes, I'm going to say a prayer and make sure God's with us. And then you can do your third step prayer. And I said, okay. And I bowed my heads and I got my arms around the old man. And he starts praying. I have no earthly idea what he says. Because in my head, I am praying my ass off. And I guess he quit praying and there was some silence there. And he's like, I need to hear what you're saying to God. And now I'm on the spot, you know. And I said, you know, try not to cry. You know, dear God, I've tried to get sober since 1988, and I'm scared, and I don't want to die drunk. I need your help. Please give me the willingness to do whatever I got to do to get what's in this book. Amen. And he said, stand up. And he gave me a hug. And he says, you just did the third step prayer. Look at the top of that page. I love this page. When I first got sober, I swear, every Friday night at Homeward Bound, I had to read page 63. You know, the guys would come in, they'd get out of treatment. Hey, you still reading page 63? Yeah, that's what I do, man. I love this page. But look at these promises. This is huge stuff right here. When we sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We got a new employer. There's another concept of God. Notice how employers capitalize. God's the employer. I'm just the employee. The employee gets his directions from God. We have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed. Comma. Here's the hook. If we kept close to him and performed his work well. My sponsor said, underline that. I underlined it. He says, there's your job description till the day you die. Mm-hmm. What's my job description? My job today, just as it was then, is to stay close to God, perform his work well. I've since added on to that for my guys. My job today is to stay close to God, perform his work well today, no matter what. No matter what happens. That's my job. What does it say? What's the promise? It says God's going to provide me with what I need. And Cliff said, if God's providing you with what you need, John, what else do you need? Nothing. He says, pretty simple, ain't it? Mm-hmm. I was like, wow. You know, this is good stuff, right? Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. I spent 10 years going to AA. I wasn't trying to give anything back to AA. I was trying to suck whatever I could out of you so I didn't have to drink that day. Now it's saying I got a primary purpose. My primary purpose is not to get from AA, is to give back to AA. Wow, what a change. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We are reborn. And Cliff said, welcome, buddy. You get a do-over. You're in the bonus round. Because left to your own devices, you would have woke up with a bottle of vodka next to your head. And now you're in the bonus round. I love that stuff. Look at the end of the, you know, I already did the third set prayer, but look right after the prayer where the exclamation point is. I don't know why they put it afterwards, but it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready.
It's a trick.
It is a trick. It's like, oh, we've already done the prayer. Now they tell me I got to be sure. I got a note in my book, and I wrote it. It's September the 9th, 1999. Dear John, you're never going to have your way again as long as you live. Love, God. P.S. If you follow the directions in this book, you'll thank me for it one day at a time. My sponsor says, you ain't never going to have your way again. Wow. It says, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. Right? So they're giving us, I mean, you got to remember, when the book came out in 1939, there wasn't sponsors all over the world. So they got to lay out the precise instructions on how to do these steps. AA came to Texas. You know how I got to Texas? Was it Larry Jewell? Mailed off for a book. He had a book. That's how he went through, or the lady went through the book when she had the steps. I forget. We can edit that out, right, Steve? Right? So they're giving us some instruction. He goes, the wording was, of course, quite optional so long as we express the idea of voicing it without reservation. So if any of you guys have gone through and read the history of the archive stuff and these letters from Dr. Jung to Bill and Bill to Silkworth and all that stuff, one of the key components of having a spiritual experience is this complete and absolute surrender. No lurking notion. Can't get to the spiritual experience if you hadn't conceded. Can't happen. Right? So it's pretty cool. He says, this was only a beginning. It's only a beginning. I've just made a commitment in step 3 with my sponsor and the God of my understanding that I'm going to get off my butt and work these steps. That's what step 3 is about. Think about it. Last time when you were drinking and sitting on your sofa and you needed more booze, you made the decision to go to the liquor store. Did the booze just arrive? No. You had to follow it up by strenuous action, correct? The third step has nothing to offer if I don't get off my butt and do a fourth step. Nothing. The big book, as we said in the fourth of the first edition, inside this big book is the precise instructions on how to recover. The big book, right here where I'm getting ready to read, it tells you exactly, precisely, when you begin your fourth step. Look at the next paragraph. Or let me finish that one paragraph. This was only a beginning, though, if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. I felt a huge effect on my third step. I've had guys cry during the third step. Some guys feel a little bit of the awakening, and then it hits them a day or two or a week or three later. Sometimes it'll bring you to tears. Some powerful stuff here. But look what it says. And Michael's going to cover this, but I got to, because this is so confusing in AA today. Look at that next line. It says, next, we launch on a course of vigorous action. I just did a third step. I just got up off with my knees. My sponsor has given me a hug. And you know what we did? He said, follow me. And we walked back into his office in his house. He sat me down and he gave me my instructions for my fourth step. Next. Right? Where's the gray area in next? Bill's a smart guy. Bill's a smart guy. We've got to admit. If he would have meant next month, he would have wrote next month. If he would have meant next, well, after you get your job, your wife, and your car back. He said next. Put it another way. Remember getting paid on a Friday? And it seemed like everybody in your little town is at the friggin' bank. And you're in the teller line. And you're waiting and you're shuffling up there, right? And finally, you're the person in line, right? And the next available teller goes, next. What did you do? You went right to the teller, right? Because you got to get the money. You got Christmas shopping to do. You didn't wait. You didn't wait for an epiphany. No, they called your name. Go. Next means next. That's what I'll end it with there.
That was new. I hadn't heard that yet. You know, when we look at this, but people will contend. Well, let's go back and what it said. These steps are just suggestions. That's all they are. It's a suggested program. I mean, you look at how it works. How did they word it? Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. Well, that next is just a suggestion, right? Well, let's look at it for a second. Has anybody ever been skydiving before? Jumped out of a perfectly good airplane? All right, we've got a winner. All right, let's look at this for a second. Let's educate some people in this room that have never done it before. As you strap a parachute on and you take a flight up, guess what the guy says? All right, next, we're ready to go. And you know what he says? Ready, set, jump. And you know what he says? They tell you before you jump out of a perfectly good airplane? Once you jump, you do a count, and they suggest you pull the ripcord. It is an option. You don't have to pull it. It's up to you, right? They do highly suggest, though, if you want to live, you follow their suggestions. Once it was put that way to me, I fully understood what they mean by saying, if you want to live and you're dying from this, you're going to follow the instructions. We suggest you follow the instructions. It's too simple. Oh my, lack of power, that is our dilemma in so many ways. But here we are. Step one, we formed a conclusion. The problem, am I or am I not an alcoholic? Step two, I hope this thing works. I see it works in others. It worked for the first 100. I hope this works. Step three, I'm not turning anything over. John touched on it. I'm making a commitment up to God and to my sponsor that I am going to work steps 4 through 12, which will show me how to turn my will and my life, my thoughts and my actions, over to this God of my own understanding, which will restore me to sanity. This is too simple. But have we done anything up to this point? How many decisions have you made in the last 48 hours that weren't followed by action? We make a lot of decisions during the day. Do we follow through with all of them? No. See, the only way we can follow through is follow the precise instructions. Then we come out of our third step and it says, next we launch out on a course of vigorous action. John touched on it. When I wanted a drink, I launched out on a course of vigorous action. I went to the liquor store. It's as simple as that. How am I going to back up my third step? It says, next I'm going to launch out on a course of vigorous action. The first step, which is the personal house cleaning. Wait a second. What step are we on right now? What did it just say?
First step.
See, the one thing we have to pay attention to this four step, this is the first time that Alcoholics Anonymous is going to ask you to do something. This is the first action step that is going to require action on your part without anybody else in the middle of it. This isn't talking about it. This is about doing it. And look how it describes it. The first step, this a vigorous action, the first step, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. We definitely have never attempted our own personal house cleaning, but we have attempted personal house cleaning. It just wasn't ours. I'm all about cleaning your side of the street. You ought to be doing this. I was wonderful at giving you advice. I was wonderful at taking your inventory. But when it came to mine, it says many of us have never attempted. It says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, that step three decision, that commitment, is vital, life-giving. Without it, we're not there. It says it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. What are they talking about? Strenuous effort. Next, I'm going to launch out on a course of vigorous action, which is going to be a strenuous effort to do a personal inventory. That's how I'm going to back up that vital decision in step three. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. I can't tell you how many years I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this four step was talked about as if it was a big, bad, ugly beast that should be locked in that closet, and you better be careful when you bring that thing out. I mean, I saw the people. Someone would walk up, so what step are you working on, John? And John would go, I'm working on step four, and you could just see the look on their face. You're waiting for them to send them a sympathy card. Like it was something, it was like pulling teeth out of your head. And that isn't what this thing's about. You know, if you look at step four back on page 59, it said, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I've got to understand what that means. Because I don't know about you, but the first time I looked at that, there was a word that jumped out that scared me. What was that?
Moral.
You know what's really interesting? That isn't the word I saw, though. No. What it translated in my head, just like step two, I thought step two said I had to believe in a power greater than myself, which restores to sanity. But it didn't read that. It says we're going to come to believe. But I thought it said I had to believe just by me looking at it. I thought step three said we need to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. No, it said we made a decision. When I got to step four, what I saw in my mind, how it translated, was we made a searching and fearless immoral inventory of ourselves. Did anybody else have that go through their mind? Oh, you want to know about all of that? That I don't want to ever talk about. Those skeletons that I have neatly buried in. I didn't understand what they meant. So they're going to tell us. Bill knew it, and he lays it out for us. It says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke, we have to admit. A little convenience store down the street, if he doesn't take an inventory, what's going to happen to him? If he doesn't take a regular inventory, is he going to be in business very long? Especially not in a small town, is he? No doubt about it. I mean, you better have stuff that people want, otherwise you're going to have a bunch of stuff that people don't want. And if people don't want it, how long are you going to be in business? You're not. See, we all understand understand the concept of an inventory. And that's what we're going to do. It says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. So I have to understand what that means. So let's say I do own that little convenience store, and let's say I've got a little corner devoted to just bread. Let's make this thing simple. And every Monday, I come in Monday morning, and I take my inventory, and I'm going through my bread aisle. Do I need to order bread today? And I look on my shelves, and I've got bread. Don't need to order bread today. Next week, I'll check it again and see what happens. So the week after goes by, and I walk up in Monday morning, I start going through my inventory, and I get to the bread section, and I look, and I'm like, I got bread. I don't need to order bread today. Anybody going? See, what I'm doing is a one-part inventory. Think about it. The searching part is the fact-finding. Do I have bread? The fearless part of it is the fact-facing part of it. If I go there the following Monday, 3 weeks into this deal, and I look up on my shelf and I go, I got bread, what do I really have? I no longer have a convenience store. I have a pharmacy with a lot of penicillin. That's what I have, right? I no longer have bread. I have the start of penicillin. I've got a bunch of mold spores growing, and no one's going to buy it. See, without doing both sides of that inventory, the searching and fearless, the fact-finding and the fact-facing, I've got to understand, yes, I have bread, but why have I not ordered bread in the last 3 months? I can't fool myself about values of this bread. So let's look at what it says. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. What is the truth about my bread on my shelves? I must be ordering bread that nobody wants, or my bread is too high priced. I have to find out the truth about what's really going on. If you ever pull out a 1939 dictionary, you know what one of the definitions of moral is? I'll be darned. Truth. How about that? Dictionary is pretty helpful in this thing. I've got to understand the truth. It says one object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. It says we did the exact same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. If you want to know what a searching and fearless moral inventory is, it's a fact-finding, a fact-facing, truthful, honest inventory about what's on your shelves of your life today. That's too simple, isn't it? And let's face it, our shelves are full. Have you ever wondered why we got here so exhausted? I don't know about you, but I've been carrying stuff around for a lot of years. My shelves are full. And all we're going to do is find out what's on the shelves of Michael Kelly's life as I walked into AA the first time. What's the truth about all this stuff? It says, we took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Here's a bold statement. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. I would have swore that alcohol destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And we know that Bill, in the first 100, wrote precisely what they meant to convey to you. There was no shades of gray. It was a masterpiece of the English language. And they're telling you resentments are going to destroy an alcoholic more than anything else. Take that to the bank. from it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we've not only been mentally and physically ill, but we have been spiritually sick. You notice when the spiritual side comes in, so often we want to do a 12-step call and we want to talk about the three-part of illness to a newcomer. And if you look at old-time AA, they dwelled on the malady of the body and the malady of the mind. And you know where they introduced the spiritual malady? The spiritual illness? As they were starting to walk through the 4-step. It's kind of interesting. They placed it there for a reason. Sometimes we get a little twisted around and we want to hammer that spiritual malady. And old school AA did not do that. This is when they first introduced it to someone. What is that spiritual malady? Well, let's go back to page 52 and look in the middle of it. We're having problems with what? Our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were prey to misery and depression. We had that feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. If you ever wonder what that spiritual malady is, that is it. That's what's driving that obsession for us to pick up that drink one more time. Now that we understand that, let's see what they introduce here. When this spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. How often have we got the cart before the horse in this game? I don't know about you, but the last thing I worried about was the page 52 stuff. I wanted to get my eyeballs going the right direction. I wanted to be able to walk around and not shake like a leaf on a tree, get my body back to health, get me on solid foods again. Then I wanted to be able to complete sentences one more time in my life. I'd get my mind back functioning again. And then, you know what? When I get time, I'll get back to that page 52 stuff that's kicking my butt. And have you noticed, they tell us that we've got the cart before the horse. What we need to do is forget about the body and the mind right now, and we're going to focus on that page 52 stuff. And once that is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Welcome to becoming a recovered alcoholic. If you want to know the magic handshake, the magic wand, or whatever you describe it, there it is, in specific order. So, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So in order to do a 4-step, I guess I need paper. They told us precisely what we need to do. There we go. And in order to put it on paper, what else are we going to need? A pen or a pencil. How about that? Unless you want to do it in blood, but that's a little drastic in my mind. So I got to get me some pen and get me some paper. Too simple. Now, what we're going to do in dealing with these resentments, we set them on paper, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry, and I've got to understand what a resentment is. Because you know what? They introduce that word angry, and so many of us get twisted off, and I looked at my sponsor, and now I'm going through this, and I'm like, I'm at the 24-hour club. I got two nickels to rub together, and I don't know where the next nickel's coming from. And I'm like, if you want me to write down every time I've been angry, you're going to need to bring a truck full of paper because I was born, they didn't have to spank me, I came out screaming. I've been an angry little man for a long, long time. And he said, hold on a second, you've got to understand what a resentment is. And later on, then they're going to start introducing words like grudge, harboring such feelings. See, I've got to understand what a resentment is. And a resentment is, yes, someone upset me. I got angry. Someone cut me off on traffic in the way here. It really happened, believe it or not. There was a guy in Oklahoma that was just being friendly, I guess, in his own special way last night. And he's doing a whole lot of stuff to us. I guess we're in Texas plates. I understand all that stuff. But, you know, and giving the international sign of peace, except he left out a finger, and all of that stuff. And, you know, did it upset me? Yes. Did I get angry? Sure. Did I think about him today? No. When I drive back home, am I going to be looking for that car on the way back going, that's him, and drive 50 miles out of the way trying to chase him down? Probably not. But what is a resentment? the best one I can give you. Bill's got a list. I'll use my own personal list. Why? Because they're mine and I like them. Because it's all about me today, right? Yeah. Oh, my. How about a resentment? Paul, my best friend growing up out of high school, he was like my brother. I have one sister. I never had a brother. I really wasn't close to a whole lot of people, but this guy, he was like my brother, and I told him everything. He told me everything. I trusted him more than I trusted anybody that I had met up to that point in life. One day I found out he slept with my girlfriend. Think I got angry? Just a little bit. But let's play this thing out. 20 years later, I'm introduced to a guy named Paul as I'm living in Dallas. And what's going through my mind? I swear to God, I'm over it. And all of a sudden, my mind, something reminds me of it. The name Paul comes up. I rethink it. I replay it in my mind. It's like someone playing with a remote control called My Life. And all of a sudden, we're going back to 1985 and someone's hitting play. And I get to rethink and I get to replay and I get to re-feel all those emotions that happened to me the minute I found out when Paul slept with my girlfriend, and it was like it was happening all over again 20 years later. Now that is a resentment. That grudge, that harboring those feelings, whether it be a day later, whether it be 10 days later, whether it be 10 years later. What is truly a resentment? So we're going to write these lists down. And all we're going to do, we're not going to write down why, we're going to write down Paul. If you look at the example on page 65, if you put your hand over everything but the first column, we're making a grocery list and we're going to list the people, the institutions, and the principals with whom we're angry. My dad, he was a brutal alcoholic. So dad makes the list. Paul, the IRS, the Garland Police Department, the motorcycles not wearing seatbelts. I'll get to that. So we're just going to make a list. And this isn't that big of a deal. If I can't get honest with a blank sheet of paper, I am not going to live. Do you understand? They told us in How It Works. If I can't get honest with a blank sheet of paper, no one else around, me inviting God in, please help me with this four-step. Help me go through this thing. If I can't get honest for moving the stuff that's racing around my brain for the last 35 years and put it down on a piece of paper, I don't stand a chance. I cannot get honest with myself in a blank sheet of paper. So I'm going to list these people, these institutions, the Garland Police Department, the principals, the seatbelt, and no on motorcycle, no seatbelt. The next part's the fun part. We asked ourselves why we were angry. Paul, he slept with my girlfriend. My dad, he was a brutal alcoholic. I learned to take a right hook from him. You know, whatever. You know, you go down the list. The IRS, they take all my money. The guy named FICA, I don't know who he is, but he takes money too. You know. The motorcycle cop. I got a seatbelt on 635, a seatbelt violation on 635 in Dallas. I understand that I'm supposed to wear a seatbelt. The only problem was I got pulled over by a motorcycle cop and he wrote me a $150 ticket for not wearing a seatbelt. The man then proceeded to get back onto his motorcycle and drive off into traffic. The principle of the idea that he doesn't have to wear a seatbelt and I do kind of rubs me the wrong way. I don't mind that I should do it, but he doesn't even have one. And I'm being unsafe. It wasn't funny to me at all. What is a principle? It's a rule, a law, things we have to abide by. That's all we're looking at. What's stuck in our craw? And we list them out. You know, it's all this stuff that when I got drunk, I told you all about my dad. When I got drunk, I told you all about what Paul did. And here, when I'm sober, why is it that I am deathly afraid of writing this down? It is too simple. Who it is, what happened. I don't have to go into a Hemingway rendition of, well, it was June 14th, it was a sunny day when Paul slept with me. No! What is really the problem? He slept with my girlfriend. Too simple. So now we're going to make, look, we've got the middle column down. Now we're going to look at the next column. It says, in most cases, we found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list. God, is that a lovely word. What do you do with a grudge? Now you know what a resentment is. I'm hanging on to that thing, and even when I don't know I'm hanging on to it, I'm hanging on to it. How many times have you said, I'm over that one? It's okay, I've forgiven him. Yet 5 years later, it's eating your butt one more time. It's an amazing thing. So on our grudge list, we set opposite each name and our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relationships, which have been interfered with? Let's look at Paul. Paul slept with my girlfriend. Did it affect my self-esteem? No, I was feeling better about myself when it happened. I don't think so. How about my security? How did I describe Paul? I trusted him more than anybody I'd trusted up to that point in my life. I wasn't really big on letting people in. You grow up in an alcoholic family, that's how it goes. I let him in, and my security was ruined. How about this? Our ambitions. Do you think it affected my ambitions? This guy was like a brother to me. I assumed we were going to grow up in the same town. We'd get married, we'd raise our kids in the same town. They'd be on the same T-ball team, and you know, I just assumed that he was going to be there, I was going to be there, and it's what it's supposed to be like. So much for those ambitions, right? How about the next one? Our personal relations. Some will say, well, yeah, it was your friend. How about even further than that? I go home, and my mom's asking me, Mike, why aren't you hanging around with Paul anymore? Shit. There's a conversation you want to have with your mom, right? No. Now we got to pick whose friends stay with who. We had common friends. All right, whose side are you on? It affected all my personal relationships. How about my sex relationships? I think so. I think he got me there too, didn't he? Oh, man. He got me across the board. Too simple. What did it affect? And if someone didn't affect any of that, are they going to make my list? No, it's the guy in Oklahoma. Right? You know what? He really didn't affect any of that. It's all good. Moving on. Bye-bye. So we're usually as definite as this example I gave you mine. It says, here's the next. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. So I start from now and I work my way back. So many of us want to go, you know what? Do I start out when I was 3? Because that's when I first remembered things. Well, the instructions say start now and work your way back through your life. Go through it. But nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Remember, I'm just getting honest with a sheet of paper. It says, when we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that the world and its people were often quite wrong. Hell yes, they were. Was Paul wrong? Yeah. We all agree, right? It's pretty easy. A 4-year-old is walking up and going, that ain't right. Pretty simple. But to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Why would you go any further? You're wrong. I know it. Let's move on. You know, the usual outcome is that people continue to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. No kidding. Even when we were right, have you ever been right before and it still wasn't right? That was a hard pill to swallow. You know, sometimes it ain't about being right. It is plain that life, which includes deep resentment, leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, the business of resentment is infinitely grave. Boy, there's some well-chosen words, right? Infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. I wish he'd quit sugarcoating things. For when harboring such feelings, that harboring, we're back to that grudge, what are we doing? When harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, is to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They might be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. Did everyone get the moral of that paragraph? Those last two paragraphs are not pretty. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, how about that, had that power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. You ever tried to wish away a resentment? Doesn't work very good, does it? How did I get back at Paul 15 years later when I'm down in Texas and he's I don't know where, and all of a sudden I'm reminded of it, and I'm starting to chew on my tongue about what Paul did back in 1985? How did I get back at him? I opened a bottle of whiskey and started pouring it down my throat till it darn near killed me. That'll show him. Who owned who? My God, he's sleeping like a baby somewhere, has probably forgotten about it. And this guy owns me. Think about it. How must these be mastered? This was our course. We realized that people who were wrong were perhaps spiritually sick. Quite possibly. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. So here's our first prayer for the fourth step on resentments. We ask God to help us show the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we'd cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And I know, if anybody's like me, I remember chewing on my tongue over resentment, and I'm calling my sponsor, and he said, well, did you do the prayer? Nope. Why? I don't see how that's going to help me. And he said, well, why don't you do it and call me back later? Click. Because he didn't care whether I thought it was going to work or not. What did he care about? Did I do the action that was laid out for me? And if I do that action, whether I believe it or not, look what it tells us. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. There's the promise of the prayer. Here I'm looking at Paul. I do the prayer. I follow through with the action. God's already starting to change it a little. I still don't know the truth about it, but God's helping me take a kindly and tolerant view to each and every one of these people. It's the most powerful prayer. So referring to our list again, putting out of the minds of the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Oh, there's a unique concept, isn't it? I've heard arguments in AA that there's no such thing as a fourth column. I don't understand it, but it's just not in the example. But look what it tells us. Referring to our list again, putting out of the minds of the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Point-blank questions, aren't they? Here's where we're going to take a look and see our part in each one of these items. Where is my part? What I saw in the Paul thing, I looked at it, and my honest assessment was I being selfish? I really didn't think I needed to share. I didn't think so. I went through and I didn't write down what my sponsor thought, what I thought my sponsor was looking for. I got brutally honest, and I wrote down what I saw. Was I selfish? I didn't see it. Was I dishonest? No, I'm pretty sure this upset me, and I didn't want to share. This is what I came up with. Was I being self-seeking? I did not see it. But was I frightened? Oh, this thing scared the living crap out of me, and I wrote it down. That was my own personal assessment of the situation at the time of doing my four-step. Now, it's really easy to look at someone else's stuff when it's not personal to you. And we all know how to do this. You go back to the example on page 65. Let's look at the employer. My employer, he's unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing. He threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. In other words, I'm mad at my boss because I'm drinking on the job and I'm stealing from him, and he's going to fire me over it, and I think he's just a little unjust and unreasonable, and he's a little overbearing. Am I being selfish? Just a smidge? Am I being dishonest? I'm stealing from him. Am I being self-seeking? Oh, it's all about me, ain't it? I got this thing rolling just the way I want it to be. Am I in fear? Oh, heck yeah. Why would I care about whether he's unjust or overbearing if he wasn't about to fire me? I'm in fear. I'm stealing from him. Look at this. It just stands out like a sore thumb. This whole situation is based on fear. Nail it down. Pretty easy to see. We're just going to go through each and every one of them and look at where am I selfish? Where am I dishonest? Where am I self-seeking? Where am I in fear over this thing? Pretty straightforward. It says, though the situation happened entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. We're not taking Paul's inventory here. We're taking my inventory. Where's my part? When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admit our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Notice the word fear bracketed alongside the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Now, fear is a God-given thing. We all have it. It keeps us from walking out in front of fast-moving vehicles, right? I mean, fear is a good thing. It keeps us alive. But for alcoholics, we kind of run amok with it, don't we? And here's all we're going to do. We're going to review our fears thoroughly. What are we afraid of? We're going to put them on paper, even though we have no resentment in connection with them. We're just going to go through and what are we afraid of? Afraid of dying. Afraid of drinking again. I'm afraid of my sponsor. I was. I'm afraid of his sponsor. It's my sponsor's sponsor. That old guy scared the heck out of me. And I was afraid to have more than $10 in my pocket. Anybody been there before? I was afraid I was never going to have more than $10 in my pocket. I was afraid, what if I win the lottery? What if I become successful? What if I never become successful? And I just went through the list. What are we afraid of? Then we ask ourselves why we had them. Afraid of dying. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I'm afraid of drinking again. I know what happens when I drink again. You know, and I just go through this list. We're just going to do the same thing we did with resentments as we did. And we're going to do the same thing with fears as we did with resentments. We're just going to do an inventory. They showed us how to do it. And then they introduced some stuff. Wasn't it because our self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. We talked about it. When things are going my way, God is great, the program's great, right? When I'm about to lose my job, what am I thinking about? What can I do to, how do I change this? What do I do? What if I lose it? And I start the ball rolling. And where do I go? I go from reliance upon God, and I go right to self-reliance. And how well has self-reliance worked out with you in your life to this point? Well, they say, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance is good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. It says, some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other problem. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there's a better way, we think so, thank God, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. Remember, God is going to provide what we need if we do what? Stay close to Him and perform His work well. I am going to trust God knows what He's doing. He's calling the shots. He's the director. I'm just the actor. He's the father. I'm the child. It says we trust in an infant God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? How about that? No matter how much chaos I've got in my life, reliance upon God and sticking to God knows what He's doing, He's going to match all that calamity with serenity. What a promise. We never apologize for anyone depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. I swore it was for the weak. I found out later inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous working this program, here's the truth. Paradoxically, is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. Here's the fear prayer. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention of what He would have us to be. The promise, at once we commence to outgrow fear. So now I've got a resentment inventory. Now I've got a fear inventory looking just like the resentment. Now I'm two-thirds of the way through and I got about 10 minutes to talk about sex, and that's never long enough for talking about sex. But we're going to do it. Now about sex. Many of us need an overhauling there, but above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Oh, then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. Our school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. Underline that. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Underline that. We all have sex problems. Underline that. There's no reading between the lines. It says we'd hardly be human if we didn't, but what can we do about them? See, this thing isn't about judging what someone deems, and we get all twisted up about the sex thing as being the act. Oh, you want to hear about all those immoral things that I think I've done? Well, no. Let's find out what it really means. What is a sex inventory? We reviewed our sex conduct over the past years. Where had we been selfish? Where had we been dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom did we hurt? It's nothing about the act. It's about how did we treat the people we so-called cared about. These people that we said, oh, I love you, don't leave me, I'll never do it again. Think about it. We treated complete strangers better than we treated the people we so-called cared about. And all we're going to do is go through and look at who are these people? How did we harm them? Straightforward. What did it affect? Here's a fun one. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? You ever tell her that, honey, I'm going to be over at Joe's house? You leave the house and you're making damn sure you're not going to be at Joe's. So when she calls, she gets to figure out where I'm at. That'll teach her. Anybody been there before? Fun stuff, arousing bitterness. That jealousy, flirting with that girl over there in the corner just so she can see me do it, just so I can get back at her because I'm just really not happy with her right now. Nice. Oh, man. Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all done on paper and looked at it. It is hard to duck and dodge this one. I didn't see that stuff with Paul, but oh, my God, it's... Where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I inconsiderate? Where was I full of fear and looking at this stuff? I didn't know anything about relationships. Mine were hostage situations. You were either going to do what I wanted you to do, or I was going to try to brainwash you into doing what I was going to do, or I eventually had to make you go away. What a great way to have a relationship. Know all about it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal of our future sex life. Obviously, there was nothing sane or sound about mine. It says, we subject each relationship to the test, was it selfish or not? Here's the first sex prayer. We got a couple of them for this fourth step. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. Obviously, our old way of doing things wasn't sane and wasn't sound. We obviously need a new way, and here's where we're going to ask God for help. It says, we remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideals turn out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, here's our prayer. We ask God what we should do about each specific matter, and here's the promise. The right answer will come, and here's the hook, if you want it. Boy, how many right answers have you got that you didn't want? You know, and the fact of the matter is, the answers will come if you want them. The most repeated, if you sponsor anyone, this is probably one you're going to hear a lot of coming back from people you're sponsoring. God alone can judge our sex situation. That is wonderful, that is true, but look at the next sentence. Counsel with others? With other person is often desirable. Who's that other person? Your sponsor, who knows you best about your hostage situations. Your sponsor. But let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice, like shopping for the right answer in your group. If my sponsor didn't give it to me, I'm going to ask the next 10 people who I think like me for the right answer. Anybody ever try that before? A lot of hysterical thinking and advice comes that way. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? So you know what? So I'm sobering up and I get in another relationship and it turns into a hostage situation and things go bad. Does that mean I'm going to get drunk? Well, some people tell us so. It says, but it's only half truth. It depends on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we'll be forgiven and we'll learn our lesson. If we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. We are not saints. We will fall. We will fall short. But the fact of the matter is, if I continue to be a low-down SOB, they tell me, and I don't change, and I'm not willing to change, and I'm not sorry for what I've done, and I'm not bringing God into the picture here, guess what, buddy? You're going to be doing some drinking. It's not their opinion. It's out of their experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for the guidance in each questionable situation, for the sanity and the strength to do the right thing. How about that? What a great little prayer. It says, sex is very troublesome. We throw ourselves harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. You get all caught up in that. My sponsor looked at me and said, get your big book and go help another drunk who was dying just like you. I'm working on my fourth step, and I'm like, how can I help him? And he goes, you got 8 days sober. Go help a guy with 8 minutes sober. You aren't going to walk him through the work, but you can give him a little hope that he just might be able to make it another 8 days. Have a nice day. Pretty straightforward. We think of their needs and work for them. It takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge. When to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down about a page, huh? I love a guy coming in. It's like, I'm done. He pulls out a little, I'm done. Really? Let me take you back to this page. We have written down a lot. It says, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward men, even our enemies, for we look at them as sick people. The only way that'll happen is if you start using that resentment prayer. Remember what the promise was to that? There it is. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past. If we can, they keep planting that seed. Have you noticed? That's the third time they start planting that night step seed. It says, in this book you read again and again that faith did for us what you could not do for ourselves. We hope that you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, step 3, in an inventory of gross or handicap, step 4, you have made a good beginning. I'll never forget, I showed my sponsor, I'm done. I felt like I have done something. Look at me. And he goes, welcome. You finally did something. You've started. You've made a beginning. I was so crushed. I thought I had done something special. I did, but again, I did the first thing AA asked me to do. That being so, we have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about ourselves, and I'll leave it with this. The truth will set you free, but until then, it'll beat the living crap out of you. Amen.
All right, thank you. Great.